Welcome to the Outrider Podcast with your host, Jason Quinn Mallott. The Outrider Podcast is a monthly conversation about writing and writers presented on behalf of Eunoia Solstice, a literary endeavor featuring thoughtful and provocative entertainment curated with the intent of fostering and inspiring positive social change through art. You can visit Eunoia Solstice at our website, eunoiasolstice.com, and investigate our other podcast, The Equivox Podcast, hosted by Eric Jenkins, or check out our essays, commentary, poetry, and short fiction. Now, here's Jason.
Welcome to episode 6 of the Outrider Podcast. Today's guest is Emily St. John Mandel, but before we get to my conversation with Emily, there's some business to take care of. If you're downloading the podcast from iTunes, please drop in there and give it a rating. If you're feeling windy, write a review. If you're listening through Stitcher, and if, you know, add it to your playlist. For those of you who've stuck with the podcast so far through all the rough sound quality and through my figuring out how to talk on a microphone, thank you. Thank you from the deep, deep regions of my heart. I've adopted the philosophy that the best way to learn how to do something is to just do it. If you wait around for someone to teach you or for all the secrets to be laid out before you, you'll probably never do the thing you want to do. So I just decided to jump in and do it. So for every episode has been it's had multiple layers of learning for me. I learn about my guests, and then I learn about audio recording and mixing, often by trial and error. It's been an adventure. Sure, it's been a hair-pulling, screaming at the computer, drinking to excess kind of adventure, but it's been an adventure nonetheless. Okay, so my guest today is Emily St. John Mandel. Emily is the author of Last Night in Montreal, The Singer's Gun, and The Lola Quartet, all from Unbridled Books. We were both part of the 2009 class of debut authors from Unbridled Books, and we got in touch with each other after reading each other's book, and actually met one Christmas in New York when I went to visit my sister. Of course, Emily has leapt ahead in both the number of books and popular recognition, and deservedly so. So if you haven't been reading Emily's books, you should. She is a wonderful writer. So here we go. Here's my conversation with Emily Mandel.
Hello?
Hi, Emily.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, not too bad. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
But I always like to start with an origin story.
Okay, sure.
And what little I know is you're originally from Canada, correct?
I am. That is correct.
Whereabouts in particular?
I grew up on a tiny island off the west coast of British Columbia. If you can picture an island about the same size and shape as Manhattan, but with 1,000 people. So, you know, not super remote. It was only about a 10-minute ferry ride to Vancouver Island, where there are a lot of towns and a lot of people, but still a little bit isolated. So I grew up there, and then when I was 18, I auditioned successfully for the School of Toronto Dance Theatre. I was obsessed with dance when I was a kid, mostly ballet, but then as I got older, I was more and more interested in contemporary dance. So that was pretty much my post-secondary education, was dancing at this professional training program in Toronto. It was pretty intense. So I was there in Toronto for about, I guess it was 4.5 years, and then came down to New York, went broke, went up to Montreal because the rent was cheaper, and then missed New York and came back here. And that was about 11 years ago. So I've been in New York for a while now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did you dance professionally for a while, or was it just
for about 10 minutes? It was a very brief career. The truth of it was, by the time I graduated, I was a little bit burnt out on dancing. Mm-hmm. It was more or less all I'd wanted to do since I was 6 years old. And by the time I was 22, I was just a little bit done. So I danced very briefly with a couple of independent choreographers, which was wonderful and a great experience. And I have a lot of memories of that time and often look back at it, but I was ready to move on by that point. I didn't really pursue it once I came down to New York.
So what burned you out?
I think just doing the same thing for too long, which must have meant that it was the wrong thing in some sense. and, you know, I'm so glad that I was a dancer. It was it was a lot of it was a lot of good training and discipline, which certainly carries over to writing, as you know. But yeah, it was just, that was my dream when I was 6 years old. By the time I was 22, it just wasn't fun anymore. I kind of fell out of love with it, I guess.
So how then, I mean, were you always then, I assume you were always a reader. Most people who end up becoming writers were always readers, but did you always write?
Yeah, more or less. I had kind of an unusual upbringing in that I was homeschooled as a child. And in the U.S., that's often code for fundamentalist Christian, which I wasn't. Yeah. My parents were, I wouldn't call them, well, I guess they were sort of hippies when I look back on it. Yeah, it was more of a counterculture slash not having grade schools in the area situation than anything else.
Right.
I was raised atheist. So I was homeschooled, and it was kind of a slapdash curriculum. But one of the requirements was that I had to write something every day. So yeah, it didn't have to be long. It could be a little poem or, you know, a short story, a page long. But I did have to write something. So I was in the habit of writing from when I was quite young. And then after it was, when it was no longer part of the curriculum and I went into an alternative high school when I was 15, it was still just something I did as a habit. And I always just thought of it as a hobby. But then I guess there was, yeah, just a really slow transition in my early 20s from being a dancer, sometimes wrote in coffee shops, to beginning to think of myself as more of a writer, and then starting what became my first novel.
Now, another, down here in the States, alternative high school also tends to mean, you know, troubled students and things like that. So what qualifies as an alternative high school?
I'm both the same. The truth of it was, I didn't really have any interaction with the students. It was an interesting program. The deal was, it was essentially an office space with desks and a couple of quieter study areas and a computer lab. And you had to show up and clock in on a computer. And you had to be there for a minimum of 10 hours a week, but you could do much more if you wanted. They would just give you the coursework. There were two veteran teachers towards the end of their careers who were just there hanging out. And if you needed help with anything, you'd go and see them and talk to them. And it was kind of perfect for me. There was such flexibility, which I needed, frankly, because the dance schedule was so intense. I was dancing 6 days a week, and you know, there were a couple of 6-hour days in there. So I needed to be able to go to school sort of whenever I wanted. And I was just so used to working on my own. You know, when I was homeschooled, it was a very similar setup where you'd just be given the material, and if you had a question, you'd ask your mom. So the structure, or lack thereof, was perfect for me. So, that was a great experience.
That probably generated a lot of self-discipline then. I mean,
yeah, you know, I guess it would. I hadn't thought of that, but definitely you had to just do the work. You know, there were no excuses. And actually, this would have been, let me think, I guess 1995, 96. So there were also fewer distractions. We weren't all carrying the internet around in our pockets and texting each other. So that probably helped too for the success of the program.
Yeah, I'm also very curious about how writers develop and when and how they develop their self-discipline, because, you know, I didn't develop mine until late.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in high school and even as an undergraduate, and I was actually studying creative writing, I was not a very disciplined student, not a very disciplined writer, kind of whenever I felt like it, and my grades unfortunately reflected that.
Right.
But, you know, I actually know that the year I developed self-discipline, I know the month and the year that I finally, you know, hammered down on it, and it was August of 97.
That's amazing that you can pinpoint it. Was there a huge jump in the work at that time?
Actually, I was unemployed.
Okay, so you had some time on your hands.
And I had some time on my hands. And I had just finished reading David Gutterson's Snow Falling on Cedars.
Oh, I haven't read that, but I've been wanting to. It's been in my to-be-read stack for years.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I had burned myself out in college trying to, you know, with that weird combination of trying to be creative but not having the discipline.
Right.
So I just kind of, you know, I flailed around and I spent 2 years not doing anything, and I read that book, and it kind of hit this little trigger in the back of my head, and I thought, that was what I wanted to do.
Right.
Right there. And I had $300 in my bank account at the time.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Right.
I took half of that, and I bought an IBM Selectric 2.
Oh, wow.
And one of those big boxes of typing paper.
Uh-huh.
You know, I didn't have a job. This was half of all of my money. I
was living in my mother's basement. That's a huge investment.
I said, you're going to have to earn this. And I haven't missed a day at my writing desks. Well, I've missed maybe a week worth spread out over, what is it now, 16, 17 years?
That's truly impressive. I love that story.
So that was how I developed self-discipline.
Right.
It's interesting. You know, some people seem to have it early on.
I had it pretty early, but then when I met my husband, he was a much more disciplined writer than I was at the time. He was the only writer I've ever met who could just sit down at his desk and stay there for 8 hours. It was pretty incredible. So yeah, I did have some advantage, I guess, in the discipline front from the homeschooling, the dance, and just having that habit of being responsible. But living in with him made an enormous difference, just living with that example.
So your dad's a writer?
No, my husband.
Oh.
Yeah.
You know, I've never met him. I met you in New York a couple of years ago in person.
That's great. I remember. It was fun.
And I know I may have asked you this, but I don't recall. Who is your husband?
His name's Kevin Mandel, and he's mostly been a playwright these last few years, but he's recently switched over to fiction, and he's got a first novel that he's revising, and he's also been writing some short fiction.
How do you manage a house with two writers?
Separate offices. That's the key. Yeah, that's my two-word answer. Actually, that's how we ended up in Brooklyn. We had been living in Manhattan, and I really liked it there. We had a little apartment on the Upper West Side. I miss Central Park a lot. But we just wanted more space. We realized it would probably be a good thing if we each had our own spaces to write in. So, yeah, you can get a three-bedroom in Brooklyn, which you can't in Manhattan for less than $1 million a month. So, so that was how we ended up out here, just for that reason, separate offices. Yeah.
And there are no ego clashes or anything like that?
No. I mean, you know, I think if you have two of anything in the same household, two lawyers, two doctors, whatever, you know, it's something that has to be consciously navigated. But it's pretty wonderful to have somebody who you can talk to about writing, who really understands, because they're in it too. And we can show each other our first drafts, which I find extremely helpful. So, I'd say on balance, it's positive.
Fascinating. I was always afraid to get involved with another writer because I think partly because of insecurity.
Right.
And also because even though I am right now in my situation desperate to have, you know, other writers nearby and early readers and stuff that are really hard to find here in Wichita, Kansas.
Right.
I also know that I have that insecurity leads to some, you know, overinflated ego. I did room with a writer when I was in grad school, and there was a really tense period of, you know, like every time I would go upstairs to the living room, my friend Laura would go downstairs.
That's awkward.
And if I'd go downstairs, she'd go upstairs because we just weren't talking to each other.
Right. Roommates. Another hell. Writers are not. It's never a good situation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I live in Brooklyn, which, you know, there's a ridiculous number of writers here.
Yeah.
You know, last night I went to a literary event with my agent, and then we said goodnight and parted ways, and a block later I ran into my editor, and I was just like, oh my God, this is ridiculous. But, you know, I actually don't really go to literary events, you know, maybe three or four a year. And one of my early readers is in Minneapolis, and he's, you know, he's a great reader of my work, and I try to be a good reader of his. So I sort of feel like with the internet, you can have community anywhere, in a way.
True.
But I can understand missing the face-to-face. Living out there.
Yeah, I find there's something. Well, I have a day job, I spend 40 hours a week staring at a computer screen.
Right. It's hard to go home and do that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really hard.
Yeah.
You know? So kind of having that opportunity to sit face-to-face with a writer just is, it's like my holy grail. It's out there somewhere. I know where it is. I'm on my little horse looking for it. But,
that's interesting. Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
So that's part of the reason I started up the podcast, because at least I can have a conversation.
Right. It's a great reason to have conversation with other writers.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah, definitely.
So Brooklyn is becoming kind of the literary mecca in the last few years. I mean, like you said, you know, you part ways with your agent on one block, and a block later you run into your editor, and everybody seems to be there right now. What is that like? I mean, to have, what is that? Is it really, really great on one hand, but also kind of little landmines of pretension all over the place?
You know what it is I feel sort of awkward about it sometimes. As I'll, you know, I'll go online and people who don't live in Brooklyn on Twitter or Facebook will be making mildly derogatory comments about Brooklyn writers. And I don't know, I just feel like I could be doing this anywhere. And I'm not sure if living in Brooklyn is good for your career or not. I honestly don't. I mean, we moved out here just to get more space. We were living in New York. So it had nothing to do with writing or moving out here. But, you know, lately I've been thinking I'd love to move to Paris. That would be fantastic. And I don't know. I don't go to very many literary events because I have a day job, too. I just can't quite find the time. You know, I feel like I can do the day job and get my writing done, but I can't do that and go out to readings every night. So, so, you know, months go by when I don't see any writers except the ones who happen to be my friends. So there is a sense that I could be anywhere. You know, I'm not sure how big an impact living in Brooklyn has actually had on me in terms of my writing.
But it is nice to know that if you're sitting around one day and you're struggling on something and you think, I'd really like to hang out with a writer, you can
walk
down the street to the bar and there's at least one there.
That's very true. I can make that happen. That is a nice thing that I shouldn't take for granted. But, Yeah, and you know, there is that phenomenon where you'll have a reading, but there will be, six other readings happening within a 20-minute radius. So, yeah, I actually, when I go on tour, I really like getting out of New York, partly for that reason. But some of my best tours have been in the Midwest, and especially up in Michigan and the Lakeshore, like Traverse City, Petoskey, those places. And but also down in Milwaukee. It's just, it's great to get away from these places like Brooklyn where there are so many writers that nobody comes out to readings because readings aren't special, you know, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that upper Midwest around the Great Lakes is a fabulous literary community.
It's fantastic. I love it up there.
There's some nice small presses up there. There's a lot of especially in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, there's a very vibrant literary community there.
Yeah, I love Milkweed Editions. I think they're based out of Minneapolis.
Oh, yeah.
Some really high quality stuff.
Yeah, I've been hunting around for a new publisher.
Oh, have you?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
We can talk about that later.
Talk about
that. I understand you have some stories too, but
I'm so grateful I'm bridled, but I did switch publishers for my book that's coming out, just because I wanted a bigger readership, which they couldn't possibly have been kinder or more gracious. I was so grateful.
I feel the same way. They took an extremely big risk on me in particular, which got my foot in the door. You know, now as I'm struggling to get another decent novel out into the world, there are actually people out there that, you know, had read the other book and sold it and stuff like that, that have, you know, kind of slipped me notes through Rebecca, my longtime girlfriend and inventory manager at Watermark Books. They slip her little notes going, what's Jason working on? Can we help?
So, wow, that's really nice.
So, Yeah, and none of that would have happened without Fred and Greg. They've,
yeah.
It's unfortunate that they haven't been able to have a big enough success with a book to really stabilize that press, because I think all of those books have been really good.
I agree with you. I think that it partly goes back to a huge problem in this country around discoverability. You know,
yes.
It is so hard to get any attention for a book that's not from one of the major presses with the massive marketing budgets. And as a reviewer on the millions, I struggle against that and do what I can and try to showcase small books that I think should be getting more attention. But it does often feel like everybody is talking about the same five books in any given month. And
right.
it's kind of depressing. I'd like to see there be a bit more diversity in terms of, you know, the presses that get the attention. And I don't know how to fix that, but it's something I think about.
I sometimes think it's just going to be patience.
Uh-huh.
You know, Amazon's not going away, and its footprint keeps getting bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the five big presses that are still out there, I mean, there are rumors that, what is it, either Hachette or Harper, one of the H publishers, uh-huh. and Simon & Schuster are going to combine next.
Oh, wow, so it'll be the big four.
Right.
Wow.
And I think the bigger the big presses get, the more they homogenize themselves,
mm-hmm.
and the more Amazon, you know, looms over everything, kind of this, you know, semi-benevolent demon, because they give out these grants to all these small presses that do translations.
Oh, I didn't know that. That's interesting.
Which is, yeah, that's incredibly good. It keeps these little houses that, you know, are fighting this quixotic little battle to increase the amount of books in translation in America.
Uh-huh.
And then they're stomping on independent bookstores left and right.
Yeah, I find really interesting. I just read a couple of days ago that Amazon's withdrawing to some extent from general publishing. That they're keeping some of the imprints. I think crime mm-hmm. and romance were two of them, but pulling back a little bit. And it seemed like an interesting illustration of the continuing relevance of the bricks and mortar bookstores. Mm-hmm. That, you know, these stores not being willing to carry Amazon's books actually had an impact. It was really interesting to read that.
Yeah, I got my fingers crossed. I love independent bookstores.
Me too.
Having worked in one, I'm particularly, you know, invested in one bookstore in particular.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure you got the advice at some point, was that, you know, make friends with your local independent bookstore.
I did, yeah.
Right. Yeah, I worked for mine for 3 years, and that's where I met my girlfriend. So
you're very invested.
I really made friends with my
yeah,
local
independent you dated
bookstore.
Your local independent bookstore.
Yes, I am romantically involved.
Mm-hmm.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
Do you still get down to, what is it, Word? That was
occasionally. Yeah, Word, and actually the one I've been going to the most often, just because it's closest to my house, is Community Bookstore on 7th Avenue in Park Slope. And that store, it was kind of neglected for a long time. When I first moved to the neighborhood, you'd go in and it was kind of musty and somehow unappealing. And I tended to just walk right by it and, you know, walk a neighborhood over to go to Green Light and Fort Greene, or go to the subway and go up to Word. But there are new owners at Community, Stephanie Valdez and Ezra Goldstein, and I've never seen a store turn around more completely. You walk in and it's beautiful, and it's all been turned around. It's really kind of been exciting to see that in my neighborhood. Yeah, so I do get into Word occasionally, but it's a few neighborhoods over, so yeah, the local one more often.
Out of the way.
Yeah, exactly.
No problem.
Yeah.
So, who have you, I mean, is it a secret, or can you tell who you've landed with now?
Oh, it's not a secret. There was an auction, which was the most exciting thing ever.
Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. And I have to assume that it's as much fun for the agent as it is for the writer. It's just a mm-hmm. wild thing. So the book went to auction in the U.S. and Canada, separate auctions, and it was picked up by Knopf in the U.S., and I went with HarperCollins in Canada.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was. I'm really excited about it, and my editors seem wonderful so far. It was a really hard choice. There were really good contenders in both countries. And then it's been a great few weeks. It was picked up by Picador in the UK, which is great. I've never been published in the UK before, and I've always wanted to.
Cool. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank
That's
you.
Awesome.
Thanks. And then it's sold to 6 or 7 countries, which is amazing. So.
Wow.
Yeah, it's just been this crazy, surreal, once-in-a-lifetime run. I'm really enjoying it. Yeah.
No, that's awesome.
Thank you. Thanks.
Well, so, let's see. Because I think there's, well, we were always told, I was always told, that usually it takes, you know, 10 years of just doing the work, even after you get your, or around about the time you get your first book published,
mm-hmm.
Until you actually hit that stage where you might actually suddenly have the, quote, overnight success.
Right. I love that phrase, overnight success. It's always somebody who's been laboring for, yeah, 10 to 20 years.
And Last Night in Montreal came out in early 2009, correct?
Yes, that is correct. But it takes 2 years to sell. I've been working on it a long time. Yeah.
How long did it take you, the first one?
The first one to write it? Uh-huh. To write it, you mean, or to sell it, or both?
Both. The combined from first word until book on the shelf.
Oh, it took forever. It was, I shouldn't say that, but it takes longer for other books. But,
yeah.
Okay, let me hit rewind to that statement. It took some time. It took me about 4 years to write that book, and it was really a discipline issue. And also, I was moving around a lot. I moved from Toronto to New York to Montreal and back to New York, and my life was a little chaotic and unsettled during that time. So it took a long time to write, about 4 years. And then once I wrote it, I think it took me about maybe 6 months to land an agent, which is not that much time. I was really lucky.
Yeah.
And then it took her about 2 years to sell it. So it was, this little literary fiction book that nobody had ever heard of me. So it was a tough market. And the book, you know, it sometimes gets categorized as crime fiction. I'm a thriller writer in France, which is kind of funny. But
oh, that is funny.
Yeah, so it's one of those books that's literary fiction, but there's also sort of a detective fiction element. And now these days, I feel like there's a lot of interest in those books. But at that moment in publishing, there wasn't. So a lot of the rejections were along the lines of, we love it, but we have no idea how to market it. You know, is it detective fiction or is it literary fiction?
So I hate that.
It's maddening. Yeah, so that was frustrating. It took about 2 years before my agent signed Unbridled. And then it came out in 2009.
That is cool.
It was cool, yeah. Yeah, it was a lucky find.
Yeah, I was about to give up.
Mm-hmm.
Because I burned through 50 agents.
Wow.
Well, yeah, I was one of those guys that tries to take advice very seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And the advice has always been, you know, research your agents. Make sure that their list and, you know, their tastes seem to lean towards yours. That, you know, you're not sending, you know, a literary novel to somebody that only deals in romance.
Right.
You know, that type of thing.
That makes sense.
So I would take the time to research them, and I would agonize over the query letter. So I didn't ever do a shotgun type of approach or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I still have a hard time, you know, telling people what's the first book about. I just kind of have my short elevator pitch, which is only about 1/3 of what the book's about.
Exactly. Yeah, the pitches are always like that.
And you know, I would send out the query. You know, maybe I'd average maybe 2 query letters every 6 months,
that's
something like
not
that.
Not a fast rate.
Not fast.
Yeah.
So, I mean, part of the length of my time is my own fault, but
right.
You know, after getting to 50 agents, I kind of was like, if I decided I was going to try the small presses, and
mm-hmm.
if that didn't work, I was going to become a plumber.
Right. Which is not a terrible industry. You know, plumbers make money.
They do.
Yeah.
Rebecca's second cousin is a plumber
uh-huh.
out in Denver. I mean, just all kinds of money.
Yeah, my dad's a plumber. He doesn't make a lot of money, but, you know, steady work.
Right.
It's a much more reliable income than writing, for example.
That is
yeah.
true. There's always a need.
Yes. So did you go directly at Unbridled with no agent?
Yep.
Interesting.
No agent at all. And they were the third publisher I tried.
That's pretty good.
And I'd kind of had a list of five. And after that, I'd got through the five, I was just going to give up.
Right.
I mean, give up trying to publish. I was just, I would still write on the side, but I wasn't going to try and make a run at it anymore. Especially, you know, when they say, oh, you know, I love the writing, I just don't know how to sell it.
Right. Right. Yeah, it's maddening. And it's funny, you know, there's just so much luck involved, which nobody really likes to admit. But it's just finding that one person who loves the book, you know, at Unbridled or Knopf or the agency or anywhere. That's what it takes. So, yeah, it's such a personal relationship that we have with books, and the way we respond to them.
Oh, my. So what's the new one? Can you talk about the new book?
Sure. The elevator pitch is it's about a traveling Shakespearean theater company in a post-apocalyptic North America. So, yeah, so quite different from my previous ones. There was a flu and the world ended.
Nice.
Thank you. Yeah.
For some reason, when you said that, what popped into my head was Angela Carter's book, Heroes and Villains. Have you ever read that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, wow.
I look for it.
It doesn't have anything to do with a traveling Shakespearean company, but it's mm-hmm. post-apocalyptic
Heroes and Villains.
Fiction.
Okay, I'll look for it. Yeah, I like that genre. It's kind of interesting and fun to
read. Oh, it is. It's absolutely fascinating.
Yeah.
What inspired this one? Was there a particular? I mean, it's kind of like the old question: where do you get your ideas? And the best
right.
answer is like at the shop on the corner down the street.
Right. So I don't know. I just made it up.
You know,
but... Yeah. No, it's a fair question. I started out thinking of it as something quite different. You know, so my first three mm-hmm. novels they're sometimes categorized as crime fiction. They have a sort of noir element. Although I just set out to write literary fiction with a strong plot, but yeah, it gets a little muddy.
There's a mystery behind it. Now I haven't had a chance to read the Lola Quartet yet. It's on my shelf with the to be read stuff.
Oh, thanks for buying it.
I go out and buy everybody's from Unbridled that I've talked to.
Yeah, excellent. It's a good policy.
I always like to help out any way I can. So, but no, they all have a certain mystery element. Somebody's got a dark secret in their past that's kind of hidden from most of the book. I can understand why that might fall into crime.
Yeah, and, you know, in the Lola Quartet, it's probably more explicit. You know, it's, yeah, I guess both the singer's gun and the Lola Quartet, or the gun in the first act goes off in the third. So I wanted to write something completely different. I have huge respect for crime fiction, for that genre, mm-hmm. but I just didn't want to be pigeonholed as that, and I felt like there were other things I wanted to write. So I had an idea of writing a book that was just about the life of an actor, a stage actor in Canada, and maybe he'd be kind of obscure and doing a lot of Shakespearean theater and just a life devoted to art. I wasn't really sure what the plot would be. Mm-hmm. And then I started to think, maybe it would be interesting if he were with a traveling theater troupe. That's sort of an interesting life. It's a really difficult life, and you know, it's a life dedicated to art. And then I thought, what if it was like a traveling theater troupe in a post-apocalyptic landscape? I guess I've been reading a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction. So yeah, it just kind of snowballed. And
right.
Yeah, it's so at this point, you know, the book, I'm working on edits. It moves back and forth in time between the post-apocalyptic era, about 20 years out, and the period right before the collapse. And I,
wow.
you know, I found it interesting to think about what the world would be like with no electricity, you know, for example, these things that we take for granted that, when you think about it, are actually sort of miraculous. Electricity and, you know, the way you're in Wichita and I'm here and we can pick up an instrument and, you know, dial numbers and talk to each other. You know, these inventions are just wild. So yeah, it was, I found it to be a really interesting process, just thinking about the world and thinking about how much we'd have to lose in a scenario like this. And, you know, this probably sounds cheesy, but in a way, I started to think of it as sort of a love letter to the modern world.
Well, that's not cheesy at all.
Well, thank you. You know, it's sort of disguised as a requiem. It's a, you know, it's a litany of loss, but that could be a way of thinking about and valuing something.
Right.
So, yeah, it's been an interesting process writing this one.
So what were some of the post-apocalyptic books that triggered this?
I guess it started with The Road, Cormac McCarthy, and I love that book. I really do. I didn't want to write anything like that book. I didn't want to write a horror novel.
That's a bit of a gut punch.
It's a bit of a gut punch. And, I didn't want to write a horror novel, which is why most of the action set 20 years out. You know, just calm down a little bit. There was that one. There was Zone 1 by Colson Whitehead. Although I guess I'd pretty much finished the book by the time I read that one. But I love that book. It was it's a wonderful character study. And at the same time, it's a zombie novel. It's also a character study, which is fascinating. He did something really interesting there.
Right.
So, yeah, there were those two. And I just have these vague memories of post-apocalyptic books that I read as a teenager. And I wish I could remember the titles, but... You know, when you read books you love when you're 13 or 14, and then in later life, it's almost like remembering a movie. You see these landscapes and the desperation and strangeness of it. So, yeah, I think that was in the back of my head the whole time.
Have you guys settled on a title for the new one yet?
The title's a little bit up in the air.
Okay.
I have three editors, which is unexpected. So one each for Knopf in the U.S., HarperCollins in Canada, and Picador in the U.K. I want to say two out of three like the title, and one's unsure, so it's hard to say. But at the moment, it's Station 11 is the title.
Is what again? Station 11?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep me posted. I want to read that one.
I will. Thank you.
I love post-apocalyptic stories. I always grew up with adventure fiction. I mean, that was kind of the... and war stories. You know, when I was a kid, other kids my age were, you know, reading the Scholastic books and the middle grade readers and everything that people were throwing at them. And I was going to the library and checking out the books on World War II.
Right.
And, you know, my dad had a collection of them. You know, there was the book on A Bridge Too Far, which used to frighten me because there was a picture of a dead soldier in it, and I would just kind of stare in horror at it. So I've always been had the apocalypse and violence and things like that have always been kind of an obsession with me. So
I
never read children's books. I think that's a problem.
I was similar, I guess. I read a few children's books and then skipped ahead. I was really fascinated by reading through the encyclopedia. You know, we had two encyclopedias when I was growing up. And
wow.
It's funny to look back on those. You know, that's kind of a lost form. You just Google it. but back when you used to have to like consult a book to look up things like the Second World War. So I was into reading encyclopedias. And similarly, I remember coming across the Second World War. And it's just, as a kid, trying to wrap your mind around the horror of that, which of course you can't. You know, you're living your little sheltered life wherever you are. It had an impact on me too.
So, you're in the final stages of the editing. Have you started something new yet?
Not really. I've made a few notes towards something new, but I have no idea what it is, really. So, yeah, I'd say no, I guess, the short answer.
So you're not one of those writers who seems to juggle, two or three projects until one of them lands, and you're like, this is the one I have to do now. And
not really. Although my books always overlap, because it takes a year for it to come out. So. What'll inevitably happen is I'm promoting a book that I finished writing, 14 months ago, and we'll have to keep on talking about that book. And I'll be like, I'm working on something completely different. I don't even remember what I was thinking. So that's happened with all my books, actually. But I'm not deep into anything new at this point. I think I'll probably wait at least a couple months until the edits are done, and and then get into it more seriously.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that I was impressed. I'm always also interested in people's method. Is one of the first arguments I ever remember having with other writers where it was the one where they would tell you, you have to do it every day.
Right. And
I'm like, I think that was part of my discipline problem before 97 was that, you know, anybody that told me you had to do it this way, I'm not going to do it that way.
Exactly. Just on principle. It's like, don't tell me what to do.
But then it turns out that I'm one of those clock-punching everyday kind of writers.
Right.
That's the only way I can do it.
Right.
But my friend that I shared the apartment with, she could hold an entire short story in her head for weeks at a time and revise it and keep it.
Wow, that's impressive.
Rolling over. And then she'd sit down on a Saturday and write the whole thing out and it'd be done.
Wow. God, that would be wonderful, wouldn't it? If you could just be writing in your head in the subway and everywhere else. What a great skill.
Yeah. It had that skill hasn't served her well trying to write a novel.
Right, that's a lot of tech.
But, yeah, so she can do great short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not writing right now, which is a tremendous loss to the world, I think.
That's a real shame. She just, she fell out of the habit of it? Or?
Well, part of it, yeah, I think fell out of the habit, and she went straight from undergrad to graduate school, and her name's Laura Holly.
Okay.
She had a short story in the 2003 anthology, The Best New American Voices.
Okay.
That was the one edited by Joyce Carol Oates, and Laura got to be the capper story at the end of the anthology.
Wow, that's a big deal.
Right, and
I'm not writing.
Nothing since.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
I told her I wanted her to be on this podcast, but the only way I was going to get her on the podcast is if she sent me a story first.
Did it work?
Hasn't worked yet.
Okay.
She's trying to finish nursing school now.
That's got to be intense.
It is.
See, not having a lot of time to write.
I'm giving her a break, but I want her to write. She was one of those writers that made me a better writer.
Mm-hmm.
So if she's not writing, how do I measure myself?
Right.
You know?
Yeah, so a combination of altruism and need to measurement. It's,
oh, absolute selfishness.
Yeah. Right, right.
I don't think altruism comes into this one.
So it's not so much for the benefit of the world, it's more.
Yeah, more just me. And if you have benefits on the side, then fine, great, whatever. But,
excellent, yeah. Yeah. Well, I hope she writes again. She sounds good.
She is very good. My own girlfriend even will admit in public, in front of people, you know, I'll say, oh, Laura's a better writer than I am. And instead of defending me, Rebecca goes, oh, yeah. She is. So,
nice.
Take me home, honey, and just beat me up. So, to whip that around to something useful, who are some of your influences? Who are the writers that kind of, you know, you see their DNA on your pages?
You know, I'm not sure anymore. Like, I feel like when I first started writing, I was pretty consciously, you know, copying's too strong a word, because I wasn't exactly going for that prose style. But, you know, let's say I was the most strongly influenced by Michael Ondaatje, he's one of these guys who's a household name in Canada, but not as well known here.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote The English Patient. That was his major breakout. Yeah.
You and I are going to have a long conversation.
Yeah, a great book. It's so beautiful. So I think he was probably my first influence. I think I've also been pretty influenced by music. And with the first book, I feel like Leonard Cohen crept into it to a pretty large extent. I was listening to his music a lot as I was writing. And something about that atmosphere, I think, came through. There's a book by Norman Mailer that I love, The Executioner's Song. And okay. I feel like, you know, I've read a few of his books. I don't always like them very much, but I really thought The Executioner's Song was a bit of a masterpiece. And I feel like it really, more than any other single book I can point to, that it changed the way I write, just the clarity of that prose style. So those are probably the two major ones. I've also read a lot of Salinger, and I think maybe he might have influenced me to some extent in the way I try to develop characters.
Right.
Yeah, I guess I'd point to those three.
Just take a moment. And Ondaatje was the writer that exploded me.
Oh, really? He was a huge inspiration for you?
Well, I had to go away to graduate school and drop a whole lot of money to find out who he was and what he wrote. I mean, I'd heard about The English Patient, you know, particularly after the movie,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, oh, it's just a chick flick.
Right.
And I went off and got into the MFA program at Naropa University, which was the program started by Allen Ginsberg and Ann Waldman, and he was there.
Oh, wow.
My first summer.
Wow.
Just came in to be on a panel because he was very good friends with the poet Robert Creeley.
Okay.
And also friends with Creeley's ex-wife, Bobby Louise Hawkins, who was my advisor at Naropa.
Wow.
And these guys had been friends, you know, going back to the 60s.
Right.
And they'd been involved with, like, Coach House Press and stuff like that, where Ondaatje had got his start with publishing.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, so he was, and Bobby always says the best way to get Ondaatje to do anything is telling that Bob Creeley's going to be there.
That's like the bait, the
Right.
Good to know.
So, yeah, unfortunately, Creeley's dead now.
Uh-huh.
So he can't get Ondaatje to do anything, apparently.
That was the end, because he could do stuff.
And so. But, you know, he came down for that, and he was on a panel discussion with Creeley and with a San Francisco poet named Robin Blazer.
Mm-hmm.
And they had this great discussion on geography and its influence on writers and, you know, borders and being an immigrant and out of sync with the dominant culture.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I hadn't read The English Patient. You know, I hadn't seen the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But that panel discussion just blew my mind. Listening to him talk, and then he got up and there was a reading later that night. And I think by the time the summer writing program was over, I had had him on my list of people to read, and by December of that same year, I had read The English Patient, In the Skin of a Lion, Running in the Family,
mm-hmm.
Coming Through Slaughter, Billy the Kid.
They're all great books. I love Coming Through Slaughter.
And it absolutely changed pretty much everything that I thought about writing.
Uh-huh.
So, and I went from, you know, being a big Hemingway fan to where it's like, Hemingway? Who's that?
Yeah, it's that combination of lyricism, but also sort of mm-hmm. muscular power about the prose. It's pretty exciting.
Have you read anything by John Berger?
No, I don't think I have.
He was apparently a big influence on Michael Ondaatje.
Oh, really? Okay. I'll write that name too.
He won the Booker Prize for a novel called G
mm-hmm.
in 71 or 72. It's amazing. It's a fabulous book.
Oh, I'll look for him.
And Berger's been on a tear lately. He's in his 80s. So recently there was a book called Here's Where We Meet, and there's other stuff that he's doing now, and that sensitivity and that compassion, that empathetic imagination that Ondaatje has, that ability to, you know, really make you feel a character,
mm-hmm.
that's like multiplied by 10 with Berger.
Oh, really? Oh, I'll definitely have to look for him.
The one I would recommend first
mm-hmm.
is called To the Wedding. This was written in the early 90s.
To the Wedding, okay.
To the Wedding. And that one has a blurb on it from Ondaatje that says something to the effect of, like, it's one of the novels that he would have to keep with him on a desert island.
Right. That's a good endorsement.
It's fabulous, beautiful book. It's heartbreaking. And that's the one that just kind of has me, you know. If I don't have an Ondaatje book to read, I read a Berger book. And if I don't have either one to read, then I go and I read a guy named Laird Hunt. So.
Right, right. It's good to have a backup. Yeah. Well, thank you for the recommendation. That's great. Yeah. I feel like there's a huge backlist that just sort of gets lost. And there's such a mm-hmm. flood of new books every month. It's hard to keep up with that, let alone read backlist. But I try to whenever I can.
Well, you know, books don't have an expiration date.
Exactly. It's a great thing about them.
And you get around to it eventually.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So you recently went to Australia.
I did. It was fantastic. I got an email out of the blue from the director of the Adelaide Festival. I'm not even published in Australia, or I will be with a new book. The
right.
Previous ones, I haven't been. So I had no idea how she even heard my name. Mm-hmm. But it was basically, I love your work, and can we bring you down to Australia? So, you know, free ticket to Australia, of course. So
right.
It was such a great experience. I loved being there. I guess I was there for about 10 days in Adelaide at the festival.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't know if you've done festivals outside the U.S., but...
No, I haven't done a festival outside of Kansas.
Okay, right. Yeah, you get outside the U.S., and there's just a different level of funding, to put it bluntly. So you show up, and they put you up in a hotel for days on end, and the festivals are spectacular, and you're paid for your time, and there's a per diem. And it's just a very civilized and kind of wonderful experience. So, yeah, so I did the Adelaide Festival. I did 4 events in 4 days, and then I had a lot of downtime before and a little bit after. And yeah, it was wonderful. I had such a great time down there.
There's this old adage, joke type of thing, you know, is that in France, every writer is important. In England, no writer is important. In America, only the successful writer is important. And in Australia, you have to explain what a writer is.
Oh, that's brutal. God. I don't know who coins these things. But the great thing, so this festival was outdoors in a park. And, you know, it was a sort of idyllic situation where you're sitting under, you know, under a tree in the shade, mm-hmm. and there are parrots flying overhead, and there's a fantastic poetry reading. And the great thing about this festival was it was free, and because it was in a park, people could bring their kids.
Uh-huh.
So families would come down from the suburbs, you know, working class, which is kind of unusual for a literary festival.
So
these working class families would show up with a bag of sandwiches and a thermos of coffee and just spend the day. You know, the kids would be running around and playing in the park, and the adults would be attending these events, which were wonderful. The programming was superb. And it was so great to be a part of that.
How are the readers in Australia?
You know, I don't really have a clear sense of what that market's like. But actually, I should take that back a little bit. I sold more books at that festival than I've ever sold at any festival. but they're obviously very open to new writers they haven't heard of, which speaks very well of them. You know, it's not a huge country, you know, non-geographically speaking. I think it's only 25
right.
million people. But there was such enthusiasm at this festival. It was wonderful.
Wow.
Yeah.
That kind of brings me, you know, I've asked this of a lot of people, and I'm going to ask it of you.
Okay.
Because I had a really bizarre experience with a poet here in town who turned out to be a total schmuck.
Uh-huh.
For a number of reasons. But he kind of embodied this idea that seems to be prevalent here in American letters, is that readership is declining and we should just surrender to it and pander to whatever small, tiny coterie still wants to go to school and learn about it.
Hmm.
You know, kind of just totally resigned to the fact that American Idol is a dominant cultural meme right now.
Right.
And I'm absolutely opposed to that. I think the thing that separates humans from the other animals isn't tool making or something bizarre like that. It's storytelling.
Uh-huh.
We are a storytelling species.
Right.
And we have co-evolved to both culturally value stories and to be genetically disposed to need them.
Mm-hmm.
$2 Radio kind of has this same philosophy. They're trying to push the importance of literature
mm-hmm.
with their press. So I'm very interested in them. As writers, it kind of, I think it is very important for us to be concerned about building a readership.
Definitely.
How do we go out and we engage the public? What can we as writers do to ensure that we and the writers who come after us have a stable or even expanding audience?
God, that's a good question. I think, you know, I had a few thoughts on this, maybe a little disconnected. I think that we shouldn't be resigned, you know, that we should keep on trying to make art in general, and I guess literature in particular in this conversation, to keep it as important as we can. Which, right. In this country, I feel like it so often comes down to education, that the quality, you know, I won't say that our public education system is bad. What it is incredibly variable, the way that I think it's a problem in this country that you can go to a public school in Scarsdale, New York, and your education will be 10 times better than the public school, you know, 100 miles south in the Bronx.
Right.
Not 100 miles, a few dozen miles south. So I think education is a huge problem in this country, but then it's also building a culture of reading. You know, we know that the biggest predictor of whether or not a child will read is if there are books in the house.
Right.
So I think we have to do everything we can to support that, to make writing reading as non-elitist an activity as possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, participating in these festivals and participating in giveaways. I love World Book Night.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, things like that, where the whole point is to push books into people's hands.
Right.
You know, and make them see books as something that's part of their lives. So I think things like that are really valuable. What else? I think that we have to not fall into the trap of, you know, the ridiculous infighting that happens in the literary world, where like print versus ebooks is a great example. You know, it's like,
right.
I love print books, but the enemy isn't ebooks. The enemy is that people aren't reading. So, you know, who cares what medium they're using,
true,
as long as you're reading literature. I guess those are my two main thoughts on the subject.
Well, this podcast and the organization that I'm part of building, that's behind it, is engaged with this idea that we can, through literary endeavors, through literary art, you know, change and shape the coming society.
I love that.
I'll send you links. You can check out our stuff, and if you have the time, we aren't. Like I said, we're building slowly, and so we don't pay anything.
It's fine. Nobody does.
Nobody does anymore, but they should. That's one of my, I don't know how many conversations I've killed with my co-curators by going, we need to figure out how to pay people.
Right.
Like, oh,
yeah.
That's the hardest thing to figure out.
It's a hard thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I don't do very much for free, but I'll do a little bit for free if it's a good cause. Yeah.
Well, that's why we call our guys curators, because we're out there trying to find people that are already doing stuff that we can say, why don't you come and just also do it here?
Right, right.
And then help us build the thing, and maybe someday we'll make some money at it.
Right. So, good approach, yeah.
Yeah, we're trying. We're wanting to be eclectic.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, excellent.
But yeah, I don't know. I just find it absolutely depressing, you know, that you can spend years working on a book, trying to write something, and you'll get it out there into the world, and people will value it. It'll be the thing that they will clutch to their chest, you know, through a rainstorm. I must save this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And financially, it doesn't mean anything.
Yes. That's
for the person that devoted all that time to it.
Yeah.
And yet Snooki gets a book contract.
Oh, it's maddening, isn't it?
You know?
Yeah, you just have to not think about Snooki or a book contract. It's the only advice I have. No, it can be extremely frustrating. And it's part of the reason why I decided to go with a bigger press. I wanted more readers. It's, you know, as we talked about earlier, it's very difficult for small presses to get the attention that that a book needs to really develop the readership and the sales that come with that. So, yeah.
Like I said, I think that'll change, though. The more homogenized the big presses get, the more opportunity opens up for the small presses that are willing to take risks and get books out there in non-traditional ways.
Uh-huh.
You know, if they're willing to forgo print and do just ebooks or a combination.
Mm-hmm.
If you've got a small press that's willing to turn books into art objects,
uh-huh.
Yeah, right. They might have stumble onto something.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting.
Who knows?
Yeah. Fingers crossed.
I think that's. We did good.
We did do good. Was that an hour?
That was an hour, about.
Excellent. That went fast.
Well, yeah. Okay, I think we're dead.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Emily, for coming on the podcast.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for hosting.
Don't go anywhere.
Okay.
All right, and that was my conversation with Emily Mandel. Thanks for listening. In a couple of weeks, we'll have David Wayne Reed. He's a Kansas City performer and writer. So, and until then, always please go and check out the UnoyaSolstice.com website, where we have regular posts and are getting ready to start taking poetry submissions. If you want to get in touch with me, of course, you can always get in touch with me through the Unoya Solstice website, where you can visit my author page, jquinmalott.com. Drop me a note. Let me know what you think of the podcast. And, of course, always rate us or add us to your list on iTunes or Stitcher. And if you happen to have any tips for GarageBand, I'd love to hear them. Other than that, thanks again, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.